Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinths in the News. Today is the eighth day of the self-existing owl moon of form, Dali Crown Chakra, Yellow Overtone Sunday. The affirmation is, I empower in order to enlighten, commanding life. I seal the matrix of universal fire with the overtone tone radiance. I am guided by the power of elegance. It's also Gregorian calendar Monday, October 25th, 2010. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve. That's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon. The schedule for my show is a little more fluid right now due to my other responsibilities and my guest schedules as well. So please check online both on the Blog Talk Radio website, that's www.blogtalkradio.com/ChristianaBTR. or labyrinthnetworknorthwest.org website, or my own website, turningtide-energetics.com, and you'll get the most up-to-date listings when you check one of those three places. My lead-in music is the first cut Icos, short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry, off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia. If any of you would like to chat while we're on the air, please go to christiana-anea at blogtalkradio.com. My guests today are Debbie and Marty Kermeen, labyrinth artists and builders extraordinaire, who have designed and installed over 60 permanent labyrinths around the country in the past dozen years or so through their company, Labyrinths in Stone. Thank you, Debbie and Marty, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You're a little quiet. Can you get closer to the microphone, please?
Sure. How's that?
That's much better. Thank you. Thank you. That's great. I tend to be loud, so I want people to be able to hear you. They're calling to hear you, not to hear me speak. So, thank you for joining me on the show today. I added a 15-minute segment to the end because having you both on the show, we got so much to cover because, Debbie, you do your own labyrinth activities as well as being involved with your company. So I have so many questions, so I added the 15 minutes. I hope that we'll cover as much as we can here. I'm going to ask Marty, I'm going to ask you a few questions first, and Debbie, please feel free to chime in if you have something else to add with anything that we talk about. So I looked through your websites and the information that you sent me, and it seems that the transition or transformation from being a hardscape designer and installer to a stone sculptor, Marty, for you, came about primarily due to your introduction to labyrinths in 1998. Prior to this, your company, Artistic Pavers, specialized in residential installations, and then you were asked to create a paver labyrinth for a church. Can you talk a little bit about this initial experience and the Naperville Millennium Labyrinth that was the result, beautiful labyrinth that was a result of this?
Sure. There was a little bit in between there, though. I had a pretty decent background at art and a lot of sculpture, and we created quite a few logos for sports teams and corporate entities and clubs like Rotary International. And then we were advertising that nationally in some landscape publications, and that's how the request to build a Chart Labyrinth came about from the church in Carolina.
Okay, I see.
So there was just a little bit of art in between the two, and that's how the question for a labyrinth come about from North Carolina when we're all the way in one of the distant suburbs of Chicago. So the thing was, I spent many months thinking about how to actually create a Chart Labyrinth with all of its beautiful detail out of pavers, because obviously you can't order one from somewhere in pavers. So you have to generate your own pieces, and there was no rule book at the time or any kits or anything. It was just, here's the math, and we're not even sure the math is right, and do you think you can do it? So I spent months thinking about it, and I thought I had it solved in my head. I'm not much of a computer person, so it was all thinking in my head, and I wanted to build it at home so I had more resources, namely more bricks if my calculations were wrong, and of course my supportive wife and business partner, who basically runs the business, who could help me solve some things and calm me down in some stressful times. And we'd done a couple of those art projects that I mentioned for the city of Naperville, Illinois, so I thought they might be receptive to the concept of a labyrinth. So I called our contact there, Pete Crawford, an architect, and said, geez, Pete, I'd really like to build you guys a labyrinth. And I told him all the reasons, but I need to do it right away because I want to go to North Carolina and build it, and I'll give you guys a great price if you will get on it right away. And he didn't think that was a possibility, but he took it to the city council and they passed it right away. And he explained the reason why is because a few years prior they had actually raised funds for a labyrinth and they couldn't find anyone to build it. So I had a need to build one and they had a need for a builder, and somehow we synchronistically locked up, and it seemed to do quite a bit of healing for the town. The people who were building other projects in the city, well, there was some disgruntled people in town, and it did a lot to heal the community. So it was a good thing for us and for the city.
So it did what it's meant to do. It brought disparate people, segments of the community together, and helped to heal those issues. That's a great story.
I have
a question. So the logos that you were doing before. So I'm trying to picture this in my mind. Pavers are rectangle or square, and sometimes they have depending on the tile or the paver that you're using, they're not rounded. So I'm assuming that in the logos that you made before, which were made out of pavers or made out of brick,
had
experience rounding these square or sides, because the labyrinth is round, and so the circles are round, and the path is round, and so in order to you have to cut them. And so you were used to doing this, and this was a familiar thing that you were doing.
Yes. A way to describe it would be sculpting. You actually pick up the brick and you hold it to the saw blade like you would sharpening a pair of scissors to a grinding wheel, and shape and carve and sculpt each brick, although in its final placement you can only see the top surface, and that's what everyone thinks about. The brick is 2.5 inches thick, and the entire thing needs cut into the desired shape, so it very much is sculpture.
So this was an extension of what you had already experienced with your other work before this, but did it take on additional meaning to you when you started doing it for labyrinths? What was the emotional experience for you? What did it change your? I mean, because you talk about yourself as a stone sculptor, so and I'm thinking like the stonemasons that actually built the labyrinths in the Gothic cathedrals. I mean, do you compare yourself to them?
Every day when I go to work, I try to judge my day's activities on whether I would have passed muster in the cathedral if I had been fortunate enough to been on that crew. So I would be honored if someone would consider me in that same category.
Oh, that's... Okay, and I'm going to go back to this. So you use a saw to cut the pavers.
A 14-inch diamond saw.
And so every paver, so do you spread out a whole design template and know where exactly where every single paver that you cut is going to go because each one is curved or shaped to a specific spot?
Some of them, originally we would go to the site and literally make it completely on site. Over the years, we've learned ways that we can create some of the pieces at home and palletize them and take them with us. They're still created by hand. We just aren't living out of a hotel room in another state. We're at home more with our families. But currently, the way we do it is we pre-cut or pre-carve, sculpt, the word you prefer to use, the center, and the lunations, but not the background for the lunations. They tend to be a little problematic getting them exactly the right size. We could generate an average, but you would wind up with problems, as is evident with some of the kits that are out there. So we generate the background by hand on site. All the paths, all the U-turns, all the labyrinths, all that stuff is done on site, but the center is cut ahead of time now. Saves us a lot.
And do you do this yourself, by yourself, each one of these?
Well, my wife, Debbie, who's on the other line here, she runs the business and does all the office and all the creating and web design and not web design, but web layout and brochures and things like that, and she does an awful lot of work at the job site. We were recently in Laguna Niguel, California, and she did a great job there, and she bailed me out when I got stung by a stingray in Sanibel Island, long time. We have an employee, George Puga, who's been with us since the late 80s, and he's still here, and he's only missed one labyrinth because his twins were born. Other than that, he likes to come with, and Debbie's helped build many of them, and she does all the office work and all that legwork as well, and I'm fortunate enough to get to go out and be in front of everyone and receive praise for our work and play in the sand.
Okay, but you personally are the one that cuts every paver.
I cut the pavers, and our assistant George does too. It's a pretty abrasive sound, so it's pretty rough, but there's a lot more to it than just cutting.
Okay, so you sent me the article. You talked about the new labyrinth in Laguna Niguel, and I actually lived in Laguna Beach 30-some-odd years ago. So I know the area well. And I know sort of the spot where you're talking, and I saw the picture of it, and it's an elongated form, and it's so cool. I said I've never seen a labyrinth like that before. But talk a little bit about, you sent me the article from the Orange County Register, and it was just officially dedicated right last month, and then you also finished another project, just finished, got back from New Hampshire, correct?
Yes. Yes, that's
and
correct.
And was that a private project or a public one?
New Hampshire?
Yeah.
It was in a public park. It was paid for with private money that was donated to the city, but the installation actually is in a public park. Rotary Commons, I believe, is the name of the park.
And where is it in New Hampshire?
Nashua. Just north of the border from Massachusetts, like the fourth exit.
I know it well.
Yep.
Near L.L. Bean, right? That's up there on the coast, isn't it? Yeah.
And New Balance tennis shoes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I read the article and the letter from the town, the Orange County, from Laguna Niguel, explaining their needs and the design parameters for the California Labyrinth. And it seemed a very complex undertaking. Can you highlight some of the issues you faced and how you approached such a commission?
Oh, that's a good question. You want to tackle that? No? Well, what I would say is I had a lot of help from Nancy Palmer. She is the one that had a lot of the vision of oval labyrinths facing towards Saddleback Mountain and a lot of the design concepts. She is the senior landscape architect at the Botanical Garden. And we volleyed back and forth with ideas and concepts. She knew she wanted it oval, but they didn't know how to get the pass sequence to work out. I worked on that and suggested maybe something in this long, elongated center and pitched out some ideas that were made right away. She come back with some ideas, and then I tidied those up, and that went back and forth several times. So, and Debbie had a lot of input here in our studio when I was drawing different designs of bougainvillea flowers and ribbons to connect it all together. Debbie helped me determine which ones look best, because sometimes when you're drawing, it's hard to know when you're on the right track.
Mm. The center is just gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And it's so, and I bougainvillea, I mean, you know, it grows in clusters. So
yeah,
to have the individual flowers kind of there and large in the center and have that elongated form, it's a beautiful labyrinth. And so this person, the person who is in the liaison for the town, did
mm-hmm.
she came to your studio in Illinois frequently to work with you?
No, it was all done on the telephone and internet and emails and attachments and
oh boy,
and photographs of stencils and all that. So no, we had never met until the day we arrived to do the project.
Oh boy.
We had talked
so and how long from start to finish, how long did this did it take?
I think that one was about a year and a half. We've had some that have been as long as 7 years, and Nashua that we just completed I think was 5 years that we were talking with them. So some of them take quite a long time.
Wow.
I would say the average is
wow.
about a year and a half. Will you agree with that, Deb?
I think so, yeah, about a year and a half.
We've had some go very quickly. This year we created one at a hospital in Covington, Louisiana. He called us in December, and we were there building it, the 2nd of February or something like that.
Yeah, that was the shortest on record. That went really quickly.
I think
yeah. Now, explain the reasons why that was. Was it because it was an easy, a standard form? What were the reasons why that it was such an easy or a short amount of time?
Actually, the reason that one went so quickly was because they the donor for that one, it was a single donor that paid for that project, and they had walked the labyrinth that Marty built in Audubon Park in New Orleans, and they knew immediately after visiting and walking that particular labyrinth that they were going to have the same person build theirs. So there was no real politics with, you know, bidding or proposals. They knew they wanted us, and so we were there very quickly.
I see. So you have had to actually go through bidding processes with some of these public installations.
Yes. Usually it is a bidding process, but we've gotten it now to the point where we're commissioned more like artists, and so a lot of times that will help it go through the city council or through the park district because they commission it as art, and therefore it doesn't have to go out for bid.
Got it. Right. So you also design labyrinths for private residences. You have an HGTV link to a segment about a small plot of land in the front of a renovated brownstone that you transformed for a couple in Washington, D.C. Can you talk a little bit about this commission?
Sure. There was... when HGTV called, they mentioned the little space. We needed a tiny little labyrinth that would fit nicely in that space that you mentioned was quite small in front of the brownstone. The little five circuit from India seemed appropriate because of five circuits, and what made it incredibly appropriate was the fact that in India, the folklore is that that labyrinth was used during the childbirthing process. Story I probably could go into, but maybe you shouldn't. And the lady in the house where we put it was actually pregnant at the time, so it was perfectly appropriate for their space.
And so you suggested the labyrinth. Did they had walked other labyrinths, or had they walked any of your other ones? How did you get to do the job?
I think it was HGTV who tracked us down through our website and maybe through the Labyrinth Society, of which we are founding members. I'm not sure, but I'm sure our website played a part in it. The homeowners themselves had walked a labyrinth that another Labyrinth Society member had built in a
botanical garden
there in D.C. as part of the show, and that was their experience with labyrinths. We, of course, sent them a drawing of what we were proposing, and they approved it, but I think the homeowners had had very little experience with labyrinths, that it was the designer on the show that was the labyrinth enthusiast.
And so did you work with their interior designer or a decorator? Because they renovated this brownstone and changed the color, and they changed the steps leading up into the house. Did you work with them in terms of the colors?
By time they were swapping and changing out colors on this show, their bricks had already been ordered and were on their way. So the color of the pattern, really, or the pavers or labyrinth, was not changed during the process. But they did do a bit of shuffling of paint colors there at the end. But it seemed to work out nicely with the colors that we had already chosen.
Yeah, it's
adorable.
They could have maybe spent a little more time on the labyrinth part of that program instead of the paint choice, because they made big drama over the paint. And the labyrinth was so cool and had so much history behind it. We really wish they would have focused more on that, but we really had no control.
Yeah, we did give them about 30 minutes of footage that they left on the editing room floor. But it was a little disappointing, but we were happy to be there, and it was a great opportunity and experience, and their designer was, I cannot remember her name right now, but she was very pleasant.
Uh-huh. And so this one in New Hampshire, you said it's a rotary, it's in the town.
Yeah.
What type of design is it?
It's a full-size Chart replica.
I'm sorry, you faded out there. Shark Rock?
I
what,
said it's
labyrinth?
A full-sized Chart replica.
Replica, I gotcha.
Replica.
And what are the colors of the pavers?
Red path and charcoal lines. I guess in the northwest, that's what they're, or northeast, I'm sorry, that's what they're used to seeing, and they thought they should stick with tradition. They have a lot of... if you've been there, you know they have a lot of red brick sidewalks there in the downtown area, so it made sense to go with red.
Okay. And what was I going to ask you? Sort of forgotten. Okay, I'm going to continue, and I'll think of it later.
Okay.
Debbie, I'm going to Marty explained what you do. So you still are the office manager, and you handle the PR marketing for your companies, the Artistic Pavers and Labyrinths and Stone.
Yes, we do a lot of it together. The marketing and the PR is so easy with what we're doing with Labyrinths. For one thing, we love them and we're passionate about them, so it's really not hard to promote something that you believe in. So that just kind of flows. In fact, when we were in Laguna, I did a lot of marketing on every place I went, every store, every restaurant, every waitress or server that served us. You know, I told them about the project, and I believe that I sent a lot of people that to come up and walk that labyrinth, just from talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not hard. It's very, very easy to promote something, you know, that you believe in and that has so many good things surrounding it.
And do you get involved with the designs for the commissions too?
I help, like, you know, I guess I'm kind of a spark thrower. An idea will come in the door or through an email, and, you know, we start talking about it, and you know, I throw ideas and spark certain thoughts and creativity that helps to kind of make the projects turn out the way that they do. Marty's more of the builder. He's more of the sculptor, and I kind of help him keep it all together. So I have helped design a couple of them, like the Reflection Labyrinth that I think you were going to ask us about later. in the interview.
Yeah, yeah. Let me get just ask in the marketing. Has the marketing focus changed over the years as your company, as more and more people hear about you and know about you? Has it changed, or can you? Because I know for people who have Labyrinth businesses, it's interesting to hear. And marketing is always a big issue. Marketing, PR of your company, what you do, and making it unique is always an issue. So it has that changed for you, or has the focus changed?
Well, it's definitely changed as far as the people that we are marketing to. You know, now it's more of the spiritual. It's more hospitals, churches, more about healing, retreat centers. So it has changed in the way that we're not doing as much corporate, like the dial logos and the bulls at the Berto Center when Marty did the Chicago Bull for them. It's changed in the way that it's just kind of a different audience that we, you know, that we have now. And usually they're coming to us looking for... We don't have to do a whole lot of outreach. It seems like through the Labyrinth Society, the international group, through them, and then through our connections with other Labyrinth builders, you know, we all work together. We tend to have a very a good repertoire with other Labyrinth builders. And so a lot of our work, it's just not difficult at all. But it has changed as far as the audience goes.
Mm-hmm. And what's the biggest PR or marketing challenge you faced over the years with your Labyrinth projects?
Probably would be in the early years of trying to be a Labyrinth builder in 99. I mean, there was a lot of folks that come before us, a lot of your previous guests, Helen and Robert and John Ritter and many others. Neil Harris, as a matter of fact, we went to one of his seminars when we first learned about Labyrinth. But we were in fairly early in 99, and at that time, not a tremendous amount of people knew what Labyrinths were, so it was fairly difficult to be a Labyrinth builder, much less a full-time Labyrinth builder at that time. So that was probably the greatest challenge, was educating the public in general as to what a Labyrinth was, with lots and lots of help from other Labyrinth folk around the country, and until knowledge was spread wide enough that we could do it full time.
Mm. And do you market to prospective clients outside the U.S.?
We really pretty much just through the Labyrinth Society, which is international, as you're aware. So through our connections through that, and, you know, coming up, the gathering coming up, and all the people that we'll see and connect with. That's really the only, and the website, obviously, anybody can bring up to look at, but that's really all we do as far as internationally goes. We really count on the Labyrinth Society for that.
We've been published in quite a few international books, you know, in Australia and Austria and German, and, of course, Sayward's books there in England. And so we've been in quite a few books around the world, but we've not really been asked to create many Labyrinths anywhere besides America and a few in Canada that didn't come completely through, but we did talk to them for quite a while.
Uh-huh. Okay. And Debbie, your bio says you were a dancer, or you are a dancer, and you founded the Fox Valley YMCA School of Dance in Plano, Illinois in 1987. Did your dance background influence your involvement with Labyrinth?
Well, of course, you know, with the movement and the Labyrinth being a dance all by itself, yes, it definitely has influenced my work with the Labyrinth. I do drumming walks. I do Tai Chi on the Labyrinth, which I really, really enjoy. Any kind of movement on the Labyrinth, especially with children, because children just will really get into it and let go. I hope to do more. I would love to do some choreography using the Labyrinth in the future, but we lead pretty busy lives with what we have going on right now, just building them and all the traveling and keeping everything going. Now our daughter Chloe is teaching for that same program that I started, you know, in 1987. She's an instructor there now. I am not teaching right now because I'm very involved with all the Labyrinth work, but yes, I do definitely find ways to use that with my facilitating.
And you're also a healer and an energy worker, and you co-created the Reflection Labyrinth. Who did you co-create that labyrinth with?
That was Marty. Actually, Marty was working on a design at our kitchen table one morning, and I was doing the dishes, and he was trying to come up with this new design, and he had one, and I was kind of watching a little bit out of the corner of my eye, and he decided it wasn't going to work because it had one side that you would walk and then the other side that you would walk. And he said, who's going to want to walk one side of a labyrinth and then the other side of the labyrinth? And so he pretty much balled it up and threw it in the garbage. And I went and got it out of the garbage can. And I said, you know, wait a minute, this has some potential here for doing some healing and to bringing some people together. And so it just all started. It started from there. He got it out of the garbage. We made it into two different entrances instead of the single entrance at the entryway. And since then, it's had really good. People seem to really like it because you do get to walk one side of the labyrinth, and then you get to switch places with the other person and walk in their footsteps. So it's very good for any type of family counseling, individual work, the 12-step program, weddings, creativity workshops, and it's great fun to do a drumming workshop using that labyrinth with the drums.
Hey, don't forget to tell her about South Africa.
Oh, yes, and then the Reconciliation Labyrinth. Actually, our Reflection Labyrinth had a baby labyrinth, and Claire Wilson had come to a workshop that Kimberly Sayward and I did in California. And she left that workshop, and she came back in, and she said, I had a really big awakening here. She said, would it be okay if I used your design in South Africa? And, you know, of course, I said that would be wonderful. Marty and I both agreed that would be a really neat thing to have it be used there for healing in South Africa. And so she changed the design, and she now calls it the Reconciliation Labyrinth, and it is doing some wonderful work. Our little Reflection Labyrinth definitely has sprouted and found a lot of different ways to do wonderful work in the world. So we're really thankful for that.
So is this on canvas, or do you have one permanently built someplace?
Well, we have one built at a cancer hospital that is in Ohio. It's at the Halser Medical Hospital, and that's the only permanent brick one that we have that's the Reflection design. I have also painted it with Judy Hoban, who is a good friend of mine, and she had one commissioned from a boys' home, which is called Sears Boys Center in Missouri, and they wanted to have the Reflection design on canvas. So her and I painted it together in the studio there where she's at, and in St. Louis, and that is being used to do some wonderful work with boys who have been incarcerated and who are going back out into the world, and they use it as a metaphor for them to change their path and to change to a better life when they get out. So
is there a single, since I have not seen a picture of this, I hate to say this, but I did not go and check this out, and I apologize. Is it a single center?
It is. The center is a single circle, but the design has two pathways at the entrance. So you actually walk with another person if you choose, or it can be with something else on the other side. And it's like a dance. You come together and you go apart. And then there's a place called the sharing space. And what you do is you switch places and you walk in the other person's footsteps. So you're walking your whole side, and then you switch places and walk the other side. And then you can go into the center together and back out. And if you want to see the design, it is on our website. And I'm trying to think if we have an actual drawing of it on the website. You may have to see it. What do we have it on?
I think it's only on the hospital page in Gallipolis, Ohio. I don't think we have a drawing on the website.
Well, we'll have to work on putting the drawing up of it, or the canvas labyrinth because that turned out beautiful. We made it a very curvy when Judy and I drew it and painted it, and it turned out really spectacular. So we need to get a copy of that on the website.
And how many circuits is it?
It's 9 circuits.
Okay.
And
for the reconciliation one in South Africa, is that in a permanent place, or did she put it on canvas and she travels around with it?
Actually, they've done both. There is a permanent one, and she has a wonderful website. If you even just type in Reconciliation Labyrinth, it talks a lot about the permanent one that they have there, Cape Cod, I believe, or what is the name of the?
Cape Town.
Yes. It's right at Cape Town. It's right. They have a permanent one they did out of stones. And then I do believe she has a canvas one, and I believe she's done other places.
You should touch on Judy a little bit there. You mentioned her in passing as to who Judy is.
Right. Judy is our friend from St. Louis with Labyrinth Enterprises. She is the, you know, Labyrinth painter extraordinaire and a dear friend. And she promotes the Reflection Labyrinth quite a bit. And she loves the design, and she seems to really like what people get from it.
Well, you've conducted a lot of labyrinth events with children in schools. You mentioned about loving working with children on the labyrinth. Can you tell us some highlights of your experiences working with the kids and in the schools, or what was some of your favorite memories that you have?
Well, I can think of quite a few. The Growing Tomorrow's World Labyrinth, which is at Centennial Grade School in Plano, Illinois, that one was a lot of great fun, mostly because there were so many layers to the project. We started going into the classrooms and talking to all of the classes about labyrinths, teaching them history, teaching them how to draw the Seven Path Classic. And, of course, they taught us a ton of things just because they're so smart, and they came up with all kinds of things, spirals in nature. They just loved it. We'd walk into the school, and they'd be so excited to even see the labyrinth people, And they actually were able to. They did an art project with painting the pavers to do with things with nature, and then they were actually able to, each one to lay their paver down on the line and be a part of building it. Their families came and helped for a weekend with hauling gravel and compacting and raking and doing all the labor, and that was a lot of fun because they taught us so much, and it was just really fun planting all those little labyrinth seeds that would, grow, and now they all go around and tell people about labyrinths, and it just feels like you're really spreading about how good labyrinths are for the planet when you teach all those children about them.
One of my favorite moments. One of my favorite moments with Debbie and children was last year for Labyrinth Day. She had this idea to do a pinwheel labyrinth in a park here where we live, and it happened to be the big craft show at the same time. So there was hundreds of booths, and there wound up being a lot of families and a lot of children. And then this labyrinth that we laid out out of pinwheels that Debbie had purchased. And watching Debbie with the children in the park that weekend was one of the most inspiring things, to just see her in her element and how much the children got from it, and to watch their parents smile and just see that wonderfully touching moment in the park that went on for 2 days solid. It was quite a moment, and I really learned a lot by observing that day.
So a pinwheel. Okay, so you pinwheels, like the pinwheels that are on the stick, and you stick in to keep the birds away from your gardens.
Well, yes, we actually ordered them from Oriental Trading, and it took over 600 of them to create the design. And talk about energy, with all those little pinwheels going.
They were very colorful. It was quite festive. Nothing.
And what kind of labyrinth was it?
I can't remember. I think we did a 6-circuit labyrinth.
Yeah, I
can't remember. It was just like the one in Laguna, only not oval. Same path layout, but round, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think it was.
And did you lay it out yourself, or did you have the children help you?
Some family friends' children helped us, but Debbie and I did a lot of it because we wanted it nice and round, and there was a lot of pounding of a nail into the ground to make a hole to put the pinwheels in and stuff. So I think the children were more involved in the running and playing aspect and the construction aspect on that one. But many others we've done, we involve the children in the construction part.
Yeah, and another neat thing with that particular labyrinth was that it was also coordinated with the Pennies from Heaven program for the local food pantry. So that day people would walk the labyrinth into the center, and there was a big rain barrel, and they would put their change in the rain barrel.
Hello?
And then that money was all donated to the food pantry.
Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Oops,
hello?
I've lost them.
Hello?
Deborah?
Got to call
Marty?
Back.
Hello?
Oop, we seem to have lost the connection. Hello? Oh, no. I've lost them. I am so sorry, but there's no caller on the air. I've lost Deborah and Marty. I hope they'll call back. Oh, there they are. Here we go.
Hello.
Hi.
Sorry.
I don't know what happened.
Can you hear us?
You there? Yes,
hello?
I can hear you. I don't know what happened. It just all of a sudden we got disconnected. Sorry about that.
That's okay. So I was just finishing up with the Pinwheel Labyrinth, and
yeah.
I don't know how much of it you caught. Can you still hear me?
Well, most of it. Yeah, most
okay.
of it. It's just at the end there when you were talking about, what were you talking about? Yeah, it was just at the end. I mean,
it was just a brief.
Just
Pennies from Heaven, and the money went to
yes.
the local food pantry.
So they got to the center, and then what happened in the center?
There was a big rain barrel, and then anybody that had spare change in their pocket, you put the change into the rain barrel, and then that money was all donated to the local food pantry.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
You know, an interesting side note to that was that a lot of folks showed up with their shoebox full of change that they wanted to put in the rain barrel, but we made them walk the labyrinth to get there, so they were introduced to a labyrinth sort of without them really knowing they were going to be introduced to it, and they all seemed to appreciate it and like the process.
That's great. That's wonderful. So you're going to be at the gathering, obviously, the Labyrinth Society's gathering that's coming up next month in New Harmony, Indiana. Can you talk a bit about the labyrinth in Evansville, Indiana, at the University of Southern Indiana that you helped to create and install there?
Sure. Robert Ferrey from the Labyrinth Company in St. Louis, he made first contact with them, and it was actually his project. And he sent me a couple of design ideas, and we tweaked them a little between us and come up with a nice design that they liked, and then talked about which style of pavers. They wanted one that was smoother than we usually use. We usually like to use a nice rounded profile pavers. It gives it a more aged look and cast shadows, which give it dimension, but they wanted something smoother. And we had to devise how big the space would be, you know, what proportionally to change it all. And they didn't want to, they had a big project, so we were one small piece of it, and we couldn't break the bank, so there were some budget issues. But it was wonderful working with Robert. I think that's like the eighth one we've done together. Most people would think that being competitors and both labyrinth builders that we should not really care for each other would be the norm in America, but we tend to be great friends and help each other out, and it seems more in the spirit of the labyrinth to go that route. And besides, we like each other.
Absolutely. But, okay, so tell me, and this is, I remember the question that I was going to ask before when we were talking about the New Hampshire one. In terms of preparing to put this kind of labyrinth, it's a paver labyrinth, full permanent labyrinth, you have to prepare the site sometimes quite extensively depending on where the labyrinth is going to be located and how cold the ground gets and how far down the frost table is. Can you talk about that a little bit?
We always prepare our base below the pavers like we would like it to last forever. Jeff Sayward pointed out that we shouldn't use the word forever because there's labyrinths in history that are made out of plaster that lasted hundreds of years, and there's ones made out of stone that were destroyed by bombs. So the future will decide what labyrinths stand the test of time. But we always go out with the intention of making them last as long as we know how to do. We never cut corners, and as I mentioned, we try every day to make everything we do to a standard that we hope a crew chief in Sharp would have been happy with. And they made theirs last 800 years, so if we can even manage a fraction of that, we'll be in some pretty good company.
And so how deep have you had to go sometimes in order to, and when you dig it out and then it's just ground or underneath, do you have to put a layer of sand or a layer of gravel? What kind of preparation do you do before you can actually put the pavers down?
Well, the ideal situation was, and it doesn't always work this way, but ideally for longevity of a project, the best way to do it would be to have someone local dig out the space for a 15-inch deep hole, slightly larger than the labyrinth, and then pour a concrete ring that is 6 inches wide and 15 inches deep for containment. Then the labyrinth can't spread from a freeze-thaw cycle. No matter where you're at, it's not going to expand beyond that concrete ring that has rebar in it, so it's all contained nicely. Then we do a gravel base. We compact it in 4-inch layers, so it's not just a big 12 or 15-inch deep layer of gravel with a crust on top. We put a thin layer, wet it and compact it, a thin layer, wet it, compact it numerous times until we get up to the height that we want, and then we put a crown in the center of 4.5 inches so that it has nice drainage in all directions. So it's compressed. We've learned that we have to use the stone that local road makers would use. It varies. In Illinois, it's limestone. In Virginia, it was blown up mountainside from making foundations. There was granite in New Hampshire. It depends on where you're at, what it should be. But the locals know what material is the most cost-effective and compacts the best in their area. And that's what we use. And it's generally, I said, a 15-inch deep hole. So the base is 12 inches. There's 3/4 inch of sand, and then 2.5 inches of pavers on top of that adds up to your 15-inch hole.
And do you put grout in between the pavers, or is this just they're just butted against one another?
They're butted against one another, and then we sweep sand in the cracks, and we use a method of compaction and water that is not a normal industry standard, and it tends to lock everything in incredibly tight. Everyone always asks the question, what keeps someone from stealing the bricks? But if you were to take a pair of screwdrivers and try to remove one, you would see that it's a very laborious process, and the fun wears off before you're even done with the first one. So there's really no desire from anyone to do anything like that. We went back recently to a job in South San Francisco that had a bad paver, and I couldn't get it out. I chipped the edges so badly I had to destroy it with a 3-pound sledgehammer to get it out of the hole to put in a replacement.
Wow. And so you do that this mixture of water and sand after everything's laid?
Yes. That's what locks everything in. All the bricks are laying there loose on that very thin 3/4-inch sand bed for weeks and weeks and weeks while we cut and rearrange all the pieces so that everything is exactly where we want it. And then before we sweep it in with sand, we go over it one last time and place every single brick exactly where it should be with the right gap and the right angle and the right perspective. And then
wow.
Keep it in and lock it in place. That's one of our biggest challenges. Yeah. Is people are so enthused to be on the labyrinth, we have a very difficult time keeping them off before we sweep in the sand.
It's not ready. It's not ready.
Over and over and over, and it actually seems that caution tape attracts them more. So if you put up a barrier, then you're really in trouble. So the good thing of that is, labyrinths are so wanted and needed, and people are so enthusiastic about them that they can't wait to be on them, and that's a wonderful thing.
Right. Right. We have a caller, so I want to get this this person on the air quickly.
Okay.
I just wanted to, one more question, though. The labyrinth in Evansville, is that a traditional 11th Circuit chart?
It is, but it was modified for budgetary and size reasons.
Does it have the lunations around the edges?
It does, but they're modified and done in a very rigid way instead of the normal rounded, you know, full detail.
Which, okay, got it.
You know,
and the one, did you have any
to create them? It took a day.
Oh my golly! Did you have anything to do with the labyrinth, the modern one at New Harmony?
No, that was Robert Ferret and another gentleman from Purdue University, I believe. But that was a year or two before labyrinths come into Debbie and my life.
Okay. Let's get this caller on right now. So here we go. Hi, welcome to Labyrinths in the News. You're on the air. This is Christiana. Who am I talking to?
Sorry.
Say that again. Sorry. You're breaking up a bit. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And tell us your name again.
Alice Martin.
Hi, Alice. Nice to have you on. Welcome.
I in particular would like to ask about the Heart in the Park, a labyrinth that Marty did in a very small town, Tonkawa, Oklahoma, that I visited a few years ago. I'd like to know how that small town happened to build it, and I would expect the experience of building in a place like that would be unusual.
Oh, yes. Two-part question. So the first part is there was a very forward-thinking art teacher there at the community college who her and her husband had the idea, and I think what sparked them was we had previously done a labyrinth in Ponca City about 20 miles down the road. And Standing Bear Park, and then seeing that one sparked them to thinking about putting one in the park in their own community, and then the town is has called themselves the Wheat Heart of America for quite some time, and then it was a natural for them to ask for a heart-shaped labyrinth. And as far as a unique experience, boy, you really got that right. It was a wonderful little town with some very enthusiastic people. They came down regularly for cookouts in the park while we were building it. They fed us generously. They loved helping us. They brought their lawn chairs down to watch. We become close friends with numerous people from the community. Their labyrinth committee was an awesome group of folks, as they always are, but extraordinarily so there. I think maybe part of what was so unique there was the fact that being a small town, there's not an awful lot of things to do. And we were a new and interesting thing in town, so there was a lot of enthusiasm about us being there. So it put us in sort of a mode where people were appreciating who we were. And some other installations, we've been brought in by an architect and you work in front of the hospital and they assume you're a professional and they leave you alone and there's really not much said to you besides here's the space and we know you know what you do, so do it. So this one was uniquely different from that. And it was great fun. Met some wonderful folks. Mayberry.
Marty, would you?
It was Mayberry with cell phones.
Would you mind repeating the name of the town and the name of the labyrinth?
It's Tonkawa, and they call it Heart in the Park, and it's Tonkawa, Oklahoma. And they're geographically very near the center of America. That's why they call themselves the Wheat Heart of America.
And what kind of labyrinth was it?
It was a heart-shaped labyrinth that they knew they wanted a heart, but they had no idea how to make a labyrinth inside of the shape of a heart. So they kept on us for a while, and we were kind of busy building some other labyrinths, but when we had some time, focused in on it, and some of the problems became apparent, and I had a recollection that some of you probably know that a seven-path classic labyrinth can be derived from a Greek key pattern. Have you seen that Japanese-like fan thing that will spread out and make a chart or a seven-path classic from a Greek key? And do you know what I'm speaking of?
I do, yes.
Yes, so thinking of that, if you look at the heart labyrinth, it's actually the same seven circuits, but only halfway open. Instead of fully opening up the Greek key, it's been opened up 50%, and there's a matching one on the other side. So it's actually a seven-path classic on either side, two of them, one on the left and one on the right. So walkers are walking in the footsteps of many, 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 many millennium of labyrinth walkers. Jeff Sayward was a big part of that, too. Audrey, the school, college teacher there, the art teacher at the community college, and Jeff Sayward from England, the author and historian, and he did all the the CAD work on that and told me exactly where my radius points needed to be and things. Otherwise, it would have been pretty difficult.
Alice, do you have any other questions for Marty, Debbie?
No, but I would like to say I was just amazed at how much it was a part of the people's lives. When I asked directions, people started telling me, you know, some things about what a great thing it was. When I mentioned that that's where I'd been at the local restaurant, they wanted to talk about it too. It seems to be a wonderful thing for that small town.
Yes, it does. Not too long ago, we got a phone call from the art teacher, Audrey, and she told us a wonderful story about a young woman in their town that had been there for many generations who was very ill, grave situation, and a text message started going around town that they needed to get together and pray for her health and her recovery, and they naturally chose the labyrinth to descend upon, and she spoke of the 150 or so people that showed up just 3 hours later to pray for her around the heart. So it's become a community center, a natural place to gather.
Very what powerful. A wonderful story.
Yeah.
Well, we've got another caller. So let me. Only have 3 minutes remaining, so let me get this other person on the phone. Alice, you're welcome to stay on if you'd like. More the merrier. Hold on.
Okay.
Hi, you're on Labyrinth in the News. This is Christiana. Who am I talking to?
Hi, this is Lynn Randall.
Hi, Lynn. Welcome. And what would you like to talk to Marty and Debbie about?
I just really have a question. If you had a dream for Labyrinth and what they could do, what would that be?
Oh, my. Well, what comes to mind is Debbie and I have discussed numerous times that we get phone calls from places that would desire one of our labyrinths. They've seen our work on the Internet. They like the beauty of them. They can feel the positive energy just through the visual aspect on the Internet, and they'd like to have one. But when they find out, a full chart labyrinth takes us 1,000 hours to build. So if you put any kind of normal salary to that, you can see it gets quite expensive to build a full chart labyrinth. So there's many places that could really use our labyrinths that, quite frankly, don't have the budget for what we do. We can find other ways to make them less permanent or less beautiful, but those, once again, are not permanent. You know, putting boulders on the ground or something really doesn't keep them there. But what we would like to do is to get a corporate sponsor or a private sponsor or someone, a group of sponsors, who would love to support the idea of taking labyrinths to places that can't afford them, that could really use them. One that comes to mind, another Labyrinth Society founding member, Annette Reynolds, showed us some slides of an orphanage in Alabama, I believe it was Birmingham, Alabama, that had children who were afflicted with AIDS, and they were living in an orphanage. They could use one of our labyrinths.
Wow.
And Debbie and I have given away a few, but we'd like to give away a lot, but we simply can't afford it. We, quite frankly, aren't getting rich being labyrinth builders. And we would really love to have someone support the idea of us making, say, 3 a year and giving them away. And the gift would be determined maybe by a write-in campaign and have past committee chair people determine who would receive the labyrinths that year. And next year you could write in again, and we'd put in 3 a year, and it would be free to the recipient and sponsored by someone who could maybe benefit from the idea of supporting human health, spiritual health, human health. I don't know if it's a drug company or a private concern person or who it would be, but somebody out there will get it someday, and this will come, it will come full circle, and we'll be able to do it.
Thank you.
Well,
that sounds great.
I'm good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question.
Thank you, callers, for calling in. The show is now not streaming, but on still. So I'm going to block your the other calls. And Marty and Debbie, thank you so much for joining me today. Many blessings on your path, and I can't wait to see you both in New Harmony in a couple of weeks.
We look forward to it, and thank you so much for considering us for your show.
Okay. Have a great week and a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to Labyrinth in the News in the Life category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana. Join me on Wednesday, November 3rd. That's Wednesday, November 3rd at 1 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, when my guest will be Dr. Lillian Lazley. She's one of the keynote speakers at the TLS conference and gathering in New Harmony in November. Join us as we discuss her keynote topic and the unusual venue that is New Harmony, Indiana. Have a blessed week in Lakish.